from Pacifica Network. This is Democracy Now!
America's foreign policy is having a terrible impact on Africa's own notions of secularism, militarism, particularly with respect to security issues, women's reproductive and sexual rights.
We look at the state of U.S.-Africa relations, the impact of Bush's re-election, and how the war on terror has affected the continent. Then a day of embarrassment for Dow Chemical and the world's major news media as the BBC falls victim to a hoax by the Yes Men.
Happy to announce that for the first time, Dow is accepting full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe. We have a $12 billion plan to finally, at long last, fully compensate the victims, including the 120,000 who may need medical care for their entire lives, and to fully and swiftly remediate the Bhopal plant site.
But first, we go to Iraq, where a series of attacks has left more than 70 people dead over the weekend. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. consulate in the Saudi Arabian city of Jeddah came under attack early today. News reports indicate a car exploded outside the consulate. Gunmen then stormed the compound, killing four Saudi guards, taking 18 local staff members hostage. All Americans who are at the consulate are reported to be safe. And more than 80 people have died over the past 3 days in a bloody weekend. On Sunday, 17 unarmed Iraqi contractors working for the Pentagon were shot dead in Tikrit. Another 20 were wounded. On Saturday, a suicide bomber in Mosul hit a bus, killing Kurdish fighters. Also on Saturday, fighting between Shiites and Sunnis in the city of Latakia left 20 dead. Meanwhile, leaders from 40 political parties gathered Sunday in Baghdad to warn that holding elections next month will make matters only worse. Tawfiq al-Yasri, a member of Iraq's interim parliament and a leader of the Iraq National Coalition Party, said, quote, it will be the first seed of civil war. Meanwhile, the top United Nations envoy in Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, has admitted the country's security situation is not safe enough to hold national elections. He said, quote, it's a mess in Iraq. However, the Iraqi and U.S. leadership maintain the elections will go ahead as planned. Iraqi interim President Ghazi al-Yawar is in Washington to meet today with President Bush. He said Sunday on Meet the Press, quote, we do not think that postponing the election or delaying it will solve the problem. Meanwhile, Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf, on a trip to Washington, admitted the invasion of Iraq was a mistake and that it has made the world, quote, less safe. In Fallujah, the Boston Globe is reporting the U.S. military has been made the place look like a police state. The military has set up so-called citizen processing centers where U.S. soldiers take DNA samples from residents and make scans of their retinas. In addition, residents are given ID badges that must be worn at all times. The military has banned cars from the city center in an effort to eliminate the threat of suicide car bombings. In addition, the Globe reports the military is considering all men in the city to work in military-style battalions to help rebuild the city. One college student in Fallujah criticized the occupying U.S. forces, saying, quote, when the insurgents were here, we felt safe. At least I could move freely in the city. Now I cannot. Meanwhile, the only humanitarian relief group in Fallujah has withdrawn from the city. The Red Crescent said the U.S. military requested it leave for security reasons. New photographs have emerged showing U.S. soldiers abusing Iraqi detainees. One photo shows Navy SEALs sitting on top of a hooded and handcuffed detainees. Another shows an Iraqi being held with a gun to his head. Several photos appear to show bloodied prisoners. The photos appear to have been taken by soldiers in May 2003, which would make them the earliest documented proof of prisoner abuse in Iraq. The Pentagon has launched a criminal investigation. John Hudson, a retired rear admiral, said the taking of photos is illegal under the Geneva Conventions, which prohibits souvenir photos of prisoners of war. Eight soldiers stationed in Iraq and Kuwait are filing lawsuit today against the Army's stop-loss policy. The policy has prevented thousands of soldiers from returning home, even though they've fulfilled their agreed-upon commitment. The New York Times reports the names of seven of the soldiers are not appearing on the lawsuit because they fear retribution from the Army, including being given more dangerous assignments in Iraq. Meanwhile, 12 former soldiers are filing a lawsuit today against the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. The plaintiffs were all forced out of the military because of their homosexuality. In news from Afghanistan, the Washington Post has shed new light on the death of Pat Tillman, the former NFL football player who went to Afghanistan to fight. Tillman was killed by fellow U.S. troops last year, but the Army issued a distorted and incomplete account of the events to make it appear he was killed while fighting Afghan forces. Washington Post reporter Steve Call writes, quote, Tillman died unnecessarily after botched communications, a mistaken decision, and negligent shooting. The Wall Street Journal's reporting radio giant Fox News will soon become the primary news provider to radio giant Clear Channel. By mid-next year, as many as 500 Clear Channel radio stations will be airing hourly 5-minute news reports from Fox. Many stations will also carry syndicated talk shows hosted by Fox News personalities. In news from the Ukraine, the country's Supreme Court has invalidated the results of last month's presidential election. A runoff will now be held later this month. In other election news, in Puerto Rico, the candidate narrowly leading in last month's governor's race is charging the U.S. government with acting as a colonial ruler for seizing control of ballot counting in the protracted election. This, according to a report in the Orlando Sentinel. A Boston-based federal judge has decided to step in and overrule Puerto Rico's Supreme Court on how to run the recount. Gubernatorial candidate Aníbal Acevedo Vila said the move, quote, tortures the island's residents and holds them hostage. Last week, 20,000 people protested outside the federal courthouse in San Juan to denounce the decision of U.S. District Judge Daniel Dominguez. Some demonstrators held signs reading, quote, stop the federal coup, respect Puerto Rico. The British aid agency Oxfam is warning 45 million children will die needlessly over the next 10 years because rich nations have failed to live up to promises to fight global poverty. The group has released a new report entitled Paying the Price that reveals in real terms the aid budgets of rich countries are half what they were in 1960. To worsen matters, Oxfam is also estimating poor countries are now paying $100 million a day in debt repayment. Oxfam director Barbara Stocking said, quote, the world's poorest children are paying for rich countries' policies on aid and debt in their lives. President Bush has decided to replace the two top officials on the Commission of Civil Rights and is expected to appoint a longtime critic of affirmative action to head the commission. The Civil Rights Commission has been critical of the Bush administration's civil rights policies and on how the president won the 2000 election in Florida. Losing their posts are Chair Mary Frances Berry and Vice Chair Cruz Reynoso. The Washington Times reports Bush is expected to appoint former Virginia Deputy Attorney General Ashley Taylor and Gerald Reynolds, the former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Education's Civil Rights Office. Reynolds is the former legal analyst for the Center for Equal Opportunity, a conservative think tank that opposed affirmative action. In 1997, Reynolds criticized affirmative action as a, quote, corrupt system of preferences, set-asides, and quotas. 2 years ago, more than two dozen groups, including the NAACP and NOW, opposed his nomination to a post in the Education Department. Bush sidestepped the opposition by appointing Reynolds while the Senate was in recess. Reynolds' nomination to head the Civil Rights Commission, however, does not require Senate confirmation. Former Director of Central Intelligence George Tenet has called for the government to take greater control of the Internet because he claims the openness of the Internet poses a security problem. He said last week, quote, "I know that these actions will be controversial in this age when we still think the Internet is a free and open society with no control or accountability. But ultimately, the Wild West must give way to governance and control." Tenet went on to say access to networks like the World Wide Web might need to be limited to those who can show they take security seriously. Tenet's comments came during an information technology conference in Washington. The national press was barred from attending the event. And finally, this news just in from Spain. At least four bombs have exploded in Spanish cities shortly after a warning came from the Basque separatist group ETA. The attacks came on a public holiday that celebrates the 1978 Constitution and the return to democracy after the four-decade dictatorship of General Francisco Franco. On Friday, ETA took responsibility for carrying out four small bombings in Madrid.
كانت الحلوة واقفة على المراية تري بالمراية عم يتخبى القمر
ضليت الحلوة وضحيت البرداية يا غيم اللي جاي
Mirror Moon by Marcel Khalife. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Widespread violence continues across Iraq, particularly in Sunni areas of the country, as 3 days of bloody attacks left more than 80 people dead. The cities of Tikrit, Baiji, Latifia all saw violence, with the Iraqi resistance mainly targeting Iraqi security forces and civilians working with the U.S. military. Fears of the outbreak of all-out civil war in Iraq were heightened as fighting in the town of Latifia, south of Baghdad, saw the first set peace battle between Shiite and Sunni militiamen since the fall of Saddam Hussein. Mosul was the site of one of the weekend's bloodiest attacks, with a suicide bomber targeting a bus carrying Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, killing 16 people. At least six U.S. troops have been killed since Friday. The number may be as high as 11. Meanwhile, unrest continues in Fallujah despite U.S. claims last week of a military success in retaking the city. U.S. Marines still face an up-close urban battle and continue to take casualties. The only aid agency in Fallujah, the Iraqi Red Crescent Society, withdrew from the town Sunday due to the danger of operating in the area. Meanwhile, the Boston Globe is reporting U.S. military is closely monitoring the movement of all of Fallujah's residents, creating what looks like a police state. So-called citizen processing centers have been set up, where the U.S. military takes DNA samples of residents and makes scans of their retinas. In addition, residents are given ID badges to be worn at all times. Dar Jamal is with us now, an independent journalist currently based in Baghdad, one of the only independent unembedded journalists in Iraq right now. He publishes his reports on a blog called DarJamalIraq.com. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dar.
Thanks, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the latest, what has happened this weekend?
Well, it's been, as you reported, a very, very bloody and chaotic weekend here amidst the backdrop of a horrendous gas crisis, the worst I've ever seen here over the last year. We have lines at the pumps now 7, 8, 9 miles long. Basically, Baghdad is running on generators. This is also driving the cost of everything very just basically roof and basic foodstuffs because of the transportation with the rising fuel costs. It's become almost impossible to find gasoline even on the black market. So as it's winter here and people rely on kerosene and gasoline to heat their homes, even generators are now running out of fuel. It's a very, very desperate situation here now.
Dar Jamal, you wrote a piece called Trophy Hunting. Tell us what you meant.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
You wrote a piece called you wrote a piece called Trophy Hunting. What do you mean?
Well, I wrote it in response to the new photos that have been released of Navy SEALs basically taking trophy pictures with prisoners who'd been beaten and possibly tortured, and they were referred to as trophy pictures. And this is very similar to reports I've had from refugees I continue to interview who've come from outside of Fallujah, who have stated that U.S. tanks, U.S. soldiers, rather, have taken the dead bodies of fighters, tied their hands behind their backs, and lashed them to the tanks, and were driving around the cities with the city of Fallujah with them during ongoing military operations, displaying the dead bodies of the fighters as trophies and used, obviously, as some sort of sick psychological warfare against the resistance who are there continuing to fight them.
Meanwhile, Fallujah, can you talk about what has been set up there, the kind of personnel or control center where people are having their DNA taken, retina scans? Are you getting word of this in Baghdad?
We are. It's very creepy news and almost unbelievable, but I guess not quite unbelievable here in Iraq these days. They've also mentioned that they're going to try to establish work brigades of Fallujah men to, while they're wearing these identifying arm badges that they're going to get, that they will be set into work brigades, is what the military is calling them, in order to go about clearing rubble and taking part in reconstruction of their own city. They feel that this is what is going to have to be done in order to keep resistance fighters from out of the city while putting Fallujahans to work in rebuilding their own city. One of the reasons they're having to do this is because while the military has been attempting to establish some sort of reconstruction in Fallujah, they can't keep Iraqi contractors there because most are too afraid. They're receiving daily death threats from resistance who are still operating very heavily in the area. So anytime people even sign a contract to complete work or to begin work in Fallujah, most days they're simply not even showing up. So this is another reason, aside from ongoing, sometimes fierce fighting in Fallujah, that there basically is no reconstruction occurring there at all.
What about the Iraqi Red Crescent at the command of the U.S. military pulling out of Fallujah for a few days? Why are they doing that?
They were instructed by the military to leave because the military said they were going to have to, quote-unquote, comb the area around the building where the Iraqi Red Crescent was operating. Another obvious sign that there is ongoing fighting in Fallujah. It's extremely unstable, definitely not secured by any stretch of the imagination. So the IRC was instructed to leave, so they left all of their supplies there, medicines, food, as well as medical equipment, which they estimate was enough for roughly 2 or 3 days to help the people still stranded in the city out. And they've left and have not been given word or any idea of when they'll be allowed back inside the city.
Finally, Dar Jamal, in another piece, you write about the quiet of destruction and death. describe it?
Well, I interviewed a woman who went in with a previous Red Crescent, a small convoy of three ambulances that got in there last Sunday, a week ago. And she described a horrendous scene inside of Fallujah to me. She said that it was very, very quiet there, but it wasn't the quiet of peace. It was the quiet of death and destruction. She said that virtually every building, mosque, school, and house that she saw was either completely destroyed or very heavily damaged. She said that people were still going about when they could get out, which was rare, but when they could get out, they were going about burying body parts of family members that they found blown apart by bombs. Other times they were burying skeletons of bodies because the rest of the body had been eaten by dogs. She described families there who were existing by, for example, one family was taking rice, putting it in a bowl of dirty water, because, of course, there's no running water in Fallujah, and hasn't been for over a month now, putting the rice in a bowl of dirty water, letting it sit for 1 or 2 hours, and then eating that. So, of course, everyone has diarrhea and intestinal problems. Of course, there's no electricity, no fuel for stoves. It's just a horrendous situation there. And while small amounts of aid has gotten into the city, the families who are there are definitely suffering. They're all completely traumatized and really wait for something to change with very little hope in sight.
Dar Jamal, I want to thank you for being with us in Baghdad. One of the only independent, unembedded journalists there. You can read his blog at darjamalirak.com. That's DARJAMAIL, Iraq.com. And you can also link to it from our website at democracynow.org. Be safe. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, well, if you were listening to the BBC early Friday morning, you heard Dow Chemical apologize for the Bhopal catastrophe. Or, well, if you were listening later in the day, you learned it was all a hoax. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The 20th anniversary of the Bhopal gas disaster was a day of embarrassment for Dow Chemical, the current owner of Union Carbide, and major news media around the world. On Friday, the BBC World Satellite Television broadcast an interview with a man identified as Jude Finisterra, spokesperson for Dow Chemical, or so he claimed. Dow bought Union Carbide 3 years ago. It has always maintained it as, quote, no responsibility for the 84 disaster when tons of lethal gases leaked from a Union Carbide pesticide factory in the city of Bhopal, India. 7,000 people lost their lives within days, 15,000 more lost. Their lives in the following years, around 100,000 others continue to suffer from chronic and debilitating illnesses, considered one of the worst industrial disasters in history. For years, people have called on Union Carbide and now Dow to take full responsibility for the disaster and to clean up the site. Well, that's what it sounded like Dow was doing on Friday. In the TV interview, Jude Finisterra said Dow had accepted responsibility for the accident and had set up a multi-billion dollar compensation package. The hoax ran twice on BBC and picked up on newswires around the world before the BBC determined no man named Jude Finisterra worked at Dow and was an imposter. We're going to turn now, before we go to that interview, to Jude Finisterra, or so he identifies himself. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks a lot, Amy.
First of all, can you tell us who you're with?
Jude Finisterra is actually a made-up name. Jude is the patron saint of impossible causes, and Finisterra means end of the earth, which kind of represents the situation there, I think, in some way. I'm with the Yes Men, and we've done this sort of what we call identity correction on a number of different targets. This one represents our latest effort.
And what exactly did you do? How did you end up being called for an interview with the BBC?
Well, a couple of years ago, we set up a website that looked a lot like the real Dow Chemical website, but was intended to raise questions about its refusal to do anything about the Bhopal situation. You know, 18 years ago then, after the catastrophe, Dow, who owns Union Carbide, refuses to clean up the site, still doesn't 2 years after that, refuses to compensate the victims, who received $500 apiece, and Dow actually, the head of the Dow PR team went on record saying that's plenty good for an Indian, whereas in reality it only pays for a year of medical care. So with this site, we intended to explain from Dow's perspective exactly why they wouldn't do anything, and we sent out a press release saying that, in fact, Dow is responsible only to its shareholders, and no Bhopali is a shareholder. So about a week and a half ago, we received an email at this website, dowethics.com, from somebody who hadn't read it very carefully, and she wanted Dow's official statement on the Bhopal situation, and she wanted it on December 3rd, the 20th anniversary of the catastrophe. So we, of course, obliged and spent quite a while trying to figure out what our approach would be, and settled on this, the approach that we actually took, because we figured it would result in the most media and possibly a lot of media getting in the United States, which often completely ignores the anniversary.
So you went into a studio in Paris?
That's right, yeah, because I live in Paris, and Mike's here as well, and another Yes Man, and we couldn't afford to go to London, well, with the pound and the dollar, so they set up a studio here in Paris and went in on the morning of December 3rd. I was hooked in with the host in London. And it was a live interview, and I announced the good news.
Well, why don't we listen to and watch what happened? And right after this, Dow share price fell 4.2% in 23 minutes, wiping $2 billion off its market value. He identified himself as Jude Finisterra, a Dow spokesperson, being interviewed by BBC Television last Friday.
Well, joining us live from Paris now is Jude Finisterra. He's a spokesman for Dow Chemicals, which took over Union Carbide. Good morning to you. A day of commemoration in Bhopal. Do you now accept responsibility for what happened?
Steve, yes. Today is a great day for all of us at Dow, and I think for millions of people around the world as well. It's 20 years since the disaster, and today I'm very very happy to announce that for the first time, Dow is accepting full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe. We have a $12 billion plan to finally, at long last, fully compensate the victims, including the 120,000 who may need medical care for their entire lives, and to fully and swiftly remediate the Bhopal plant site. Now, when we acquired Union Carbide 3 years ago, we knew what we were getting, and it's worth $12 billion. $12 billion. We have resolved to liquidate Union Carbide, this nightmare for the world and this headache for Dow, and use the $12 billion to provide more than $500 per victim, which is all that they've seen, a maximum of just about $500 per victim. It is not plenty good for an Indian, as one of our spokespersons unfortunately said a couple of years ago. In fact, it pays for 1 year of medical care. We will adequately compensate the victims. Furthermore, we will perform a full and complete remediation of the Bhopal site, which, as you mentioned, has not been cleaned up. When Union Carbide abandoned the site 20 years ago, or 16 years ago, they left tons of toxic waste, which continues, the site continues to be used as a playground by children. Water continues to be drunk from the groundwater underneath. It's a mess, Steve.
And it's a mess, certainly, Jude. That's good news that you have finally accepted responsibility. Some people would say too late. It's 3 years, yes, almost 4 years on. How soon is your money going to make a difference to the people in Bhopal?
Well, as soon as we can get it to them, Steve. We've begun the process of liquidating Union Carbide. This is, as you mentioned, late, but it's the only thing we can do. When we acquired Union Carbide, we did settle their liabilities in the United States immediately. And we are now, 3 years later, prepared to do the same in India. We should have done it 3 years ago. We are doing it now. I would say that it's better late than never. And I would also like to say that this is no small matter, Steve. This is the first time in history that a publicly owned company of anything near the size of Dow has performed an action which is significantly against its bottom line simply because it's the right thing to do. And our shareholders may take a bit of a hit, Steve, but I think that if they're anything like me, they will be ecstatic to be part of such a historic occasion of doing right by those that we've wronged.
And does this mean you will also cooperate in any future legal actions in India or the USA?
Absolutely, Steve. One of our non-financial commitments is to press the United States government to finally extradite Warren Anderson, who fled India after being arrested in 1984. He posted $2,000 bail on multiple homicide charges and fled India promptly. We are going to press the United States government to extradite Mr. Anderson, who's living in Long Island, to India to finally face the charges. And I believe they may be lenient. We're also going to engage in unprecedented transparency. We're going to release, finally, the full composition of the chemicals and the studies that were performed by Union Carbide shortly after the catastrophe. This information has never been released, Steve, and it's time for it to be released in case any of that information can be of use to medical professionals. And finally, we're going to perform we're going to fund research. Any interested researcher can contact Dow's Ethics and Compliance Office. We are going to fund, with no strings attached, research into the safety of any Dow product, whose safety many competent scientists have raised significant doubts about many Dow products, and we do not want to be a company that sells products that may have long-term negative effects on the world. This is a momentous occasion, and our new CEO, Andrew Lavaris, who's been our CEO for just a month, less than a month, has decided to take Dow in this unprecedented direction.
Jude, we will leave it there. Thank you for joining us. Just to reiterate what Jude Finisterra, the spokesman for Dow Chemicals, has just said, he says Dow Chemicals now fully accept responsibility for the events in Bhopal 20 years ago, and they will cooperate in future legal action.
And that was the BBC television on Friday with the anchor outroing Jude Finisterra, spokesperson for Dow. In fact, this was all a hoax. And the real Jude Finisterra, or I should say the man who was posing as the person who doesn't exist, a member of the Yes Men, joins us on the phone from Paris, where he lives and from where he did that interview. Well, tell us what your real name is.
Andy Bicklebaum is my real name, and I'm with, as you said, the Yes Men.
And is that your real name?
Sure. close as it gets.
Well, let's go to the BBC apologizing for their report.
World's worst industrial accident is being remembered in India today. This morning at 900 GMT and 10 GMT, BBC World ran an interview with someone purporting to be from the Dow Chemical Company about Bhopal. This interview was inaccurate and part of a deception. The person interviewed didn't represent the company. We want to make clear that the information he gave was entirely inaccurate. We apologise to Dow and to anyone who watched the interview who may have been misled by it. Of course, BBC is investigating.
Again, that was from BBC, their apology. And then there was Dow, correcting the apology that their supposed spokesperson had issued earlier that day.
This morning, a false statement was carried by BBC World regarding responsibility for the Bhopal tragedy. The individual who made this statement identified himself as a Dow spokesperson named Jude Finisterra. Dow confirms that there was no basis whatsoever for this report. And we also confirm that Jude Finisterra is neither an employee nor a spokesperson for Dow.
That the spokesperson of Dow. Again, Dow's share price fell 4.2% in 23 minutes, wiping $2 billion off its market value before recovering all the day's losses 3 hours later. What are your thoughts today, Andy, after having done this? And how far did this news go? I mean, BBC takes it pretty far. Who else picked up this story?
Well, Amy, it seemed to get picked up pretty much everywhere. Reuters immediately wrote about the apology by Dow, and then, of course, issued a retraction itself. That was picked up by a number of places. The retraction traveled very, very far, and a lot of the articles were sympathetic and brought Bhopal and Dow into the subject again and again and again. So I think probably dozens of articles that wouldn't have been written were written about it, which was the intention, really. It was unfortunate that it had to be the BBC, because the BBC had been covering Bhopal rather extensively and well. We would have much rather hoaxed Fox or ABC or NBC or CBS, but it was the BBC that was covering the issue. Those other places couldn't give a rat's ass about Bhopal.
Well, so if you had done this hoax on Fox, you would soon be heard on many more stations than even they're heard now, because Fox has just made an agreement with Clear Channel, which owns over 1,200 radio stations in the country, that Clear Channel stations will run Fox News headlines every hour for 5 minutes.
Right, they're clearly the correct target.
Now, is it true that you issued another press release later in the day?
Yes, we felt that we owed Dow owed Dow some public relations work, so we issued an explanation by Dow that in fact the Jude Finisterra fellow in the morning had not been their representative, and that in fact everything he said was incorrect. And then we proceeded to outline exactly what was incorrect. You know, Dow was not going to remediate the site, even though it wouldn't cost very much. They were not going to compensate people to more than $500. $500 was, in fact, enough for an Indian, plenty good for an Indian, et cetera, et cetera. Everything they were not going to do, we just spelled it out for them, since all they had said was he was not their spokesperson. We thought that was insufficient.
So this was a press release that you put out under Dow's letterhead?
Right, exactly. Yeah, well, we sent it from dowethics.com and signed it Dow.
And how many people picked up that story?
Well, it was the top story on news.google.com. as was the original apology by Dow and the retraction of the apology, our own retraction of our own of Dow's apology was also for a brief time, maybe an hour or so, the top story on news.google.com. So I don't know if it was printed in anything or broadcast on anything, but it was at least there.
And the feelings of giving false hope to people in Bhopal who perhaps read these reports in the Indian newspapers?
Right. That is the most difficult thing about this. And in fact, we didn't expect it to run as long as it would. We really thought that the BBC would catch on pretty much immediately, or Dow would react even more likely immediately. They didn't react for at least an hour. And so there was a much longer time when people thought it was real.
That would mean Dow would have had to jump in and say, no, we're not sorry.
Right. And they did eventually, but they took at least an hour to do that. And we thought that, you know, they would immediately contact the BBC, even perhaps as it was running. I kept hearing voices in the background and thinking I was about to get cut off during the interview. But, you know, 2 hours later, it was still a story. So that was sad. But, you know, at the same time, we're talking about 2 hours of false hopes versus 20 years of unrealized ones and suffering for those who are still alive and weren't killed. And all hopes are false until they're realized. So, you know, any protest sort of brings false hopes. Any protest against something as maniacal as Dow, I guess, anything that's like Dow is not likely to do anything about this, and so anytime you hope that it is, it's false in a way.
Well, Jude, I want to thank you for being with us, or Andy Bickelbaum, or whoever you are. I want to thank you for joining us. Jude Finisterra, Andy Bickelbaum of the Yes Men, speaking to us from Paris. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about Africa-U.S. relations. Stay with us. Free Africa, the Twinkle Brothers, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The British aid agency Oxfam's warning 45 million children will die needlessly over the next 10 years because rich countries have failed to live up to promises to fight global poverty. The group has released a new report called Paying the Price that reveals that in real terms, the aid budgets of rich countries are half what they were in 1960. Oxfam is also estimating poor countries are now paying $100 million a day in debt repayment. We're going to spend the rest of the hour taking a look at U.S.-Africa relations, HIV, AIDS, the impact of Bush's reelection, and how the war on terror has affected the continent. We're joined by three people, by Reverend Molefe Tsele, who is General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, by Muthoni Wanyeki, who is the Executive Director of the Kenyan-based African Women's Development and Communications Network, known as FEMNET. And Sally Booker joins us again. He is Director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C. We welcome you all to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
This issue of repayment, Muthoni Wanyeki, let's begin with you and the debt. The amount of money, $100 million a day in debt repayment that countries are paying now to the wealthier countries. What effect does that have on you? Come from Kenya, but you also talk about the continent.
Well, obviously, what it means is money that should be available for public investment in health, education, general social services just simply isn't available. And even though there have been efforts around the HIPIC, for instance, the Highly Indebted Poor Countries Initiative, it's clear that those initiatives are simply insufficient. Number one, they're limited to a certain range of country. Number two, they're tied to, as usual, conditions around the macroeconomic framework underlying how countries are able to structure their economies. So calls for debt cancellation remain very high on the agenda.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Sele, how has the Bush re-election been received in South Africa? How does it impact your country?
Well, at the state level, the word we hear from President Mbeki is that nothing will change. However, on the ground, there are very serious concerns. Firstly, there's a growing a presence of conservative evangelical American groups, especially who are doing work on HIV/AIDS. But also there is an attempt to turn South Africa, which is one of the best democracy there, into possibly one of the sphere of influence in the region, so that in interventions in crisis areas such as the Great Lakes, basically the U.S. could continue to be involved through South Africa. And so there is an ambivalence, and I can safely say that in the streets of Soweto, there was a great, great depression and sadness after the results came out of Ohio.
Hmm. Muthoni Wanyeki, the effect in Kenya are you seeing the same kind of phenomenon, more evangelical groups, both from Kenya and coming to Kenya from the United States?
Definitely. I actually work for a Pan-African organization, so I should say that this impact is being felt across the continent. It's not just evangelical groups. What it means is that American bilateral cooperation money is increasingly tied to a religious right agenda in terms of how money is coming into HIV/AIDS, what kind of prevention strategies are being used, and obviously this is at the expense of full demands for women's reproductive and sexual rights, which are at the heart of the HIV/AIDS pandemic.
How concretely does it impact them? What does this mean?
What it means is that groups that are talking about the full range of reproductive and sexual rights, including the right to choice, including the need for more than abstinence-only approaches to prevention, are simply having funding cut. And it also means that states that have taken a fairly holistic approach in the past are no longer able to do so, because this is the biggest pot of money coming into HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm.
Sally Booker, you're here in the United States. You work directly on U.S. policy and on lobbying the government, educating people in this country. How are you dealing with this, and to what extent do people here understand what is happening?
Well, I think increasingly people do understand what's happening. Certainly on debt cancellation, for example, there have been movements in the United States seeking debt cancellation, the Jubilee 2000, which became the Jubilee USA Network. And we expect that in the coming year, we're going to be able to achieve some victories in terms of getting debt cancellation for at least 33 of the world's most impoverished countries, the majority of whom are in Africa. But the other critical thing about debt, and African countries are spending more on repaying these old and illegitimate debts that come from the Cold War era.
And who do they pay it to? How does it actually work?
It's largely to the World Bank and the IMF and rich country creditors like the U.S., the U.K., and France. But the vast majority is the World Bank and the IMF. Of course, those institutions are controlled by the rich countries, the G7 countries. That's $15 billion a year coming out of the African continent. That's more money than is spent on health care in the face of this AIDS pandemic. That's more money than is coming into the continent in the form of new aid or loans or direct investment. So you have this cruel irony where the poorest region of the world is subsidizing some of the wealthiest institutions and wealthiest economies in the world. But the other critical thing about debt, also about foreign assistance or aid, is the strings that come attached with it. Debt is used not just to drain resources out of Africa, but is leveraged to force African governments to implement economic policies that the West demands: privatization of hospitals and public services, privatization of public utilities like water. So it is a tool used to maintain and perpetuate this imbalance between the rich minority in the world and the impoverished majority in the world. So when we demand debt cancellation, we're talking about unconditional debt cancellation. We're trying to move the discourse toward one of reparations and ask the question of who really owes whom. Is it the poor countries that owe the rich countries, or is it really these wealthy countries that have amassed their surplus capital by exploiting poor countries over the years? And I would just say the same on HIV/AIDS. It's not just that we need more funding. Obviously, there is a need for more funding, but it needs to be funding that is provided to the Africans that are on the front lines fighting this pandemic, not by imposing fundamentalist ideologies over science.
Muthoni Wanyeki, when the stress is abstinence, what is the problem with that?
Well, the problem is, first of all, looking at the fact that the face of HIV/AIDS is increasingly that of young African women. Infection rates of women between the ages of 15 and 24 are 3 to 4 times higher than their male counterparts. So you have to look at why this has arisen. And obviously it's arisen because abstinence is not a strategy that most young African women can follow, even if they would choose to because of, you know, their own personal religious beliefs or whatever. The idea
isn't the rate also increasing most among young married women?
Exactly. And that again comes back to failures of the prevention approach. If you don't recognize that most women cannot afford to do not have the capacity to negotiate sex and to demand abstinence or to demand uses of condoms, etc., then clearly we're not getting to the heart of the problem.
What is being done in South Africa then, Reverend Saba?
Well, maybe let's complete the picture about the debt issue. You are aware that the core of African debt are bad advices that African governments receive from the World Bank and IMF, and a wasteful expenditure even by dictators, mainly really getting debt in order to procure services from U.S. companies. And then those dictators, Zaire, Mobutu, and others, then are on the scene. But what has happened is repeatedly the people have said these were odious debts that were not used in the interest of the people, which therefore must be repudiated. And the answer, the stock answer from the IMF World Bank was no, it cannot happen. And now let's fast forward to post-Saddam Iraq. And a similar situation has happened. The government had procured debts, and the argument is they were not used in the interest of the Iraqi people. And the first thing that the Bush administration did there was these debts must be repudiated. No company, the government does not owe anybody. Exactly what we were demanding in Africa, which was said, no, it cannot happen. And so it is these kinds of things that we say in the post election era, we need to begin to look at the morality issues. And for an administration that prides itself as the front runner, the purveyor of a new morality, including sexual morality, we need to begin to ask what is the balance or what is the core of that morality?
On that issue of debt repayment, on the issue of debt overall, I mean, was really President Clinton any better than President Bush? I mean, he went to Africa and really pushed through the African NAFTA. What are your thoughts on that, Saleh?
Well, he certainly wasn't any better. He had the same kind of rhetoric. He made promises of writing off so much debt for poor countries. But the U.S. administration, whether under Republicans or Democrats, has the same approach. They want to be able to dictate the economic choices of the rest of the world in the interests of American transnational corporations, in the interests of the American economy. And so even while the Clinton administration made promises about debt reduction, recession, it was still tied to the same kind of formula where the World Bank and the IMF will reduce debt if countries will adopt the economic policies that Washington is prescribing.
Quick question to Reverend Malefe Tsele about President Aristide, who is in exile now in South Africa. Mm-hmm. I must say I was stunned to see CNN last week in a casual comment of an anchor questioning their reporter in Port-au-Prince because General Colin Powell made the surprise visit to Haiti, saying, well, we all know that the U.S. backed the coup in Haiti against Aristide. Yes. That is the first time I've heard one of the networks talk about that. But what about Aristide in South Africa now?
Well, let's start by saying that South Africa has taken a position that it is going to link itself to the continent and then therefore will play a role at the request of the African Union. And President Aristide is a guest in the country, which I need to say that is hugely welcomed by a lot of the people, especially in the townships. Is a very popular person there. We see it as something that South Africa did at the request of the African Union. And so it's something that we welcome. But beyond that, there continues to be a troubling thing about how he left Haiti. Did he leave voluntarily? Did the people in Haiti take him out, or did people from outside to come? We don't know the truth about that. He himself has said there need to be an inquiry as to the events that led to his ouster. And we know that even the UN has no interest in pursuing that. And to us, this is a very troubling issue because it may be arrested today. Who will be next?
And finally, before we wrap up, Sudan and the impact it's having on the whole continent. If Muthoni, if you could respond to that and what you think needs to be done.
Well, I think the continent has tried to respond to Darfur. The African Union, as you know, took a decision to send in peacekeepers. They took a decision to send in a mission from the African Commission on Human and People's Rights to investigate the spread of the extent and form of human rights violations. I think that was extremely significant in terms of showing the shift at the intergovernmental level within Africa, because it showed Africa was ready to hold Sudan to account for what is going on in Darfur. What is needed is support for the AU's initiatives in this area. They simply don't have the resources to send in the kind of force that's needed. They also need to expand the mandate of that force so that it is more than just sort of monitoring the situation on the ground and that it's actually able to protect civilians. I think the UN has responded well in a humanitarian sense, but what we need is the kind of political leadership backed by resources under the AU banner.
And Sally Booker, having concluded your meeting with African Americans and Africans setting an agenda in the new Bush years in Washington, what have you concluded will be a strategy for dealing with Sudan and Darfur?
Right. Well, specifically on Sudan and Darfur, we agree quite frankly with what Muthoni just said. The African Union is providing leadership. It lacks the resources, much of what the United States could provide. And we need to be mobilizing people to demand that the United States support and follow the leadership of the African Union, that Americans need to know that American power can be put to good use if it is joined with the efforts of the African nations, that the United States cannot solve the world's problems, but that we can contribute our power to the collective efforts of others, and that this is a critical issue that has to be addressed in Sudan.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us, Sally Booker of Africa Action, Reverend Malefe Tsele, General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, and Muthoni Mwanyeki, Executive Director of the Kenyan-based African Women's Development and Communications Network, known as FemNet. And on our website at democracynow.org, we'll link to all of theirs. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernethy are our engineers. On Tuesday night, I'll be at the New York Society for Ethical Culture with Richard Clark and others. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can go and sign up for our Daily Digest email. I'm Amy Goodman.